Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. In this episode, I sit down with actor and Texan Luke Wilson. Apparently, Woody Harrelson has always wanted to be one member of the Wilson family. And after talking to Luke, I can see why. Growing up, he was surrounded by a cast of literary, art, and cultural figures, sort of a Dallas version of the Royal Tenenbaums. That cast included brothers Owen and Andrew and close pal Wes Anderson. Their first collaboration was Bottle Rocket, and it did not go well. But it did bring them to Hollywood, where Luke has since made a career of both mainstream and oddball films. It's the oddballs that best show his talents, and also the pure pleasure he gets from making them. I got to talk to Luke about those early days, and how he came to be so comfortable in front of a camera without any sort of training. I was also curious to know what it's been like for him to take on more complex characters in Meadowland and as the lead in Roadies, Cameron Crowe's new series about the crew of a touring rock band. And you'll find out why Luke's mom and I have quite a lot in common, and maybe we should sit down and talk. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Luke.
Nice fans.
Thank you. You know, I've been a skateboarder my whole life, and when I started this show, I decided I'm going to have something that makes me feel comfortable as I'm on TV.
Rooted.
And so every time I get a little nervous, I look down like, oh, yeah, I'm just that kid that
likes
to skateboard.
Right.
Well, thank you for coming and doing this.
No, thanks for having me.
It's weird that we haven't crossed paths before. I've photographed your brother several times.
That's what my mom told me.
Oh, really? Well, your mom and I are very close. So she said, please have my son on your show.
Get them all on there. They won't talk to me. Maybe you can get
them
to talk.
That's right. But no, I've watched you for years, and now you're doing this show. And I want to jump right into it because you're doing Roadies, which is Cameron Crowe's new television show on Showtime. And it's an hour. I don't think you can call it a drama. I mean, it is a drama, but it's Cameron's world, which there's memory and poignancy and humor and drama. And as Cameron described it to me, we'll show everything about that world except the 2 hours the band's on stage.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you look at some of the most seminal TV shows that have come out over the last 10 years, a lot of them are set in worlds that we've never seen before. A Funeral Home for 6 Feet Under, Inside the Mob for Sopranos, The Wire for Inside the Baltimore infrastructure, and this, I mean, I don't think there's ever been a TV show that shows you what it's like to be inside the community of that group of people that make a band work town to town, night to night, you know? So what is Bill's official job?
Bill Hansen, the character I play, he's the tour manager. So he's the guy that's on the road with them, which would be different than the band manager who would be back in whatever city they
right.
live in or whatever city their management company is. I'm the guy going to the venues or the gigs and to the hotel and on the bus and taking care of the band.
And did you think about how do I set the tone of this guy like right off the bat or I mean what's the work on a TV show like this that you have to do?
Well, for me, I mean, bands and musicians had always been the thing I'd read most about and was kind of the most interested in, whether it was Bob Dylan or the Rolling Stones or, you know, Neil Young. Had read every book I could ever find about those guys. That was just kind of what I liked to do. You know, also liked reading about actors and directors, but really loved reading about bands. I'm not musical, but, you know, enjoy music. So I felt kind of prepared in that way, like, you know, can talk to Cameron about, you know, Sam Cutler, like the Rolling Stones' first tour manager, or Neil Young's tour manager, or the Grateful Dead's tour manager, you know, Bob Dylan's different tour managers. And I know all those guys just from having read these kind of great in-depth biographies of those guys, so know kind of what characters they are, too. And then in terms of, you know, preparing for the show, I mean, that's one thing I talked to Cameron about was I just liked the idea of, I do think about James Gandolfini a lot and Tony Soprano just because one thing I really thought was great about that show is you'd see Tony be like a good guy, and then you'd see him be kind of petty, and you'd see him be loving with his family, and then
yeah.
you'd see him kind of, you know, in a hotel room with a girl in Atlantic City, and then being a boss, and then with his mom, and, you know, then with his uncle, you know. And so you really got a sense of the guy, but also not just one idea about him. You thought, like, well, who is this guy? He's so many kind of different people to all these different people he comes across.
Right.
And that's one thing that really appealed to me about the show, because you do, you know, within the hour and a half or 2 hours you have on a movie, you don't always have that kind of time to kind of open up a character. You kind of want to think, okay, well, this is kind of who this guy is. Whereas on a show, I've just liked the idea of showing different aspects. Like, you know, for the guy I'm playing, Bill Hansen, yeah, you do see him with, you know, he has these affairs with younger women, and then he, you know, works with these bands, and, you know, he has a boss, but he also, you know, has people that work for him. So you see these different aspects, and that's kind of just the idea. And it also just kind of, and for me personally, kind of lets me kind of relax about it, is that I don't have to do it one certain way. It's like a case-by-case basis. And just like, you know, what we've worked on so far, there are these different scenes, and Cameron does write these great, and he, you know, I think is into that idea too, that you see this guy giving these kind of impassioned speeches to his band, and then, you know, you see him getting like spoken down to by, you know, another band's manager. So you get to see the other aspects of a person.
I think it's not that different in the job you did in Enlightened with Laura Dern. I mean, that show, I think, proved how complex human relationships can be and still work.
And again, like Mike White is one of those guys like Cameron, where you meet people like that and you think, wow, this guy is a real writer, not, you know, just a director, but he's a real writer. Like, you know,
yeah,
should he be writing novels? You know,
right?
Is he wasting his time out here in Hollywood? But they're that kind of, you know, when they write characters, they write really kind of interesting, incredible people.
But do you think like mentioning Mike White and thinking of Cameron, when you get on a project with guys like these, does it make you elevate what you do too, or does it give you a different sense of purpose on your job?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it really makes me want to do a good job, and also, and I always, you know, tell them. I mean, they write so well, and there's also so much kind of humor in it, along with kind of more heavier themes, that it makes me always think of ideas. So I always am running ideas by them, and the thing that's great about those guys is they're so good about, you know, taking an idea here or there that will help me, and then just leaving other stuff by the wayside. But you never, I mean, you always just have so much confidence in somebody like that, because they are so sharp.
Yeah.
But they will kind of, you know, work on it with you too, so you do kind of feel like you're making something together. But yeah, they're just very kind of intuitive, smart guys.
What have you already learned about Cameron and his process that, like, when you really got into it with Cameron, what did you notice about him that was different?
Well, I have to kind of go back to the beginning when I think about, you know, Cameron, because for me it does go back to Fast Times. That was such a kind of, you know, it's one of those movies I can remember who I saw it with, what theater. And I still think, like, that humor coming from that script really affected and still affects, like, you know, stuff that me and my brothers and Wes Anderson, you know, started out doing and still probably trying to do, is that kind of humor. Like, you know, I don't know quite how to explain it, but, like, I was thinking about it, you know, while working with Cameron, like, Spicoli's not just a stoner, you know, that's really good, funny, sharp dialogue. Like, if I'm here and you're here, doesn't that make it our time?
I mean, yeah,
that's
right,
really,
Mr. Ham.
Yeah, that's not just kind of, you know, teen, like, Porky's humor. That's, like, good kind of Woody Allen-type writing.
Yeah.
So, you know, was really a fan of Cameron's. And then, of course, Say Anything, you know, that was one of those movies that, again, was kind of like people that were maybe just a few years older than me. But it just not, it was about teenagers, but so much kind of deeper than your average kind of teen comedy.
Yeah.
You know, it seemed like it could have been about adults. And then, you know, when we first came to town with my brothers and Wes, we were in this building at over on the Sony lot, the Sidney Poitier building, where Cameron was working with James L. Brooks, who was helping us along with Bottle Rocket. So
right.
I met Cameron and was around him quite a bit back then. And J.J. Abrams was also in the building.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And Cameron had only directed Say Anything in Singles. But, yeah, it was one of those things I thought, just in this one building, James L. Brooks and Cameron Crowe, this Hollywood's going to be great.
God, and it has been.
I mean yeah, and then Wes and Owen were in there too, but... Yeah, so I'd been around Cameron, so seeing kind of what kind of guy he was. But yeah, it is interesting to see how a guy like that works, where what's been interesting to learn is, you know, as kind and thoughtful as a guy he is, you think, well, gosh, he has to be, like, incredibly driven. You know, which he is, you know, starting out at Rolling Stone and kind of, you know, he told me the story of how he got his first random note in Rolling Stone. He was in San Diego and he went to a Kris Kristofferson show and, you know, was waiting. Kris Kristofferson had said he'd do an interview with Cameron, and then Cameron waited the whole show, and then Kristofferson was getting kind of whisked out of the venue and taken to a restaurant and saw Cameron and said, just come to the restaurant with us. They got to the restaurant, and they wouldn't let Cameron in because he wasn't 21. He was just a teenager at the time.
Right.
So Kristofferson went out into the foyer and did this little interview with Cameron, of which Cameron has a photograph. But, you know, he's a driven guy in the best sense, in terms of, like, you know, putting himself in the right position to kind of make things happen and also doing the work. And doing, you know, kind of the lonely work, hard work of writing.
Yeah.
You know, not just wanting something, he's actually doing it. But, yeah, he, I've never worked with anybody like him. And, you know, because when you think about him, he's been a journalist. You know, he did a book of interviews with Billy Wilder.
That's right.
He did a Pearl Jam documentary. He's done book forewords. He's written, like, Fast Times was a novel.
Yeah.
I saw it in the window of a bookstore.
Isn't that amazing?
I told him, like, maybe he didn't know. I really did.
Someone's...
hey, man.
Someone's ripping
off
your...
You got a novel. He's that kind of guy that you don't know that he's written a novel. But, and yeah, just the different, you know, films he's directed, that he's really, you know, a hard-working guy.
Cameron's had... four or five different careers.
Yeah.
And I think that takes something special to re-prove yourself after you've, like, made it
yeah,
in one thing.
Yeah, I mean,
thing.
They've been steps up from, you know, journalism to being a script writer. And, I mean, I've always wanted to ask him, so how was he able to direct Say Anything? Because, you know, that wouldn't have been an easy step.
No.
People would have been like, hey, just be happy to be a successful screenwriter, you know. If you want to get it made, you know, let's let, you know, John Hughes direct Say Anything. You just, you know, you
right.
can be on the set, you know. It could have very easily happened that way. But, yeah, that's what I mean about being kind of quietly driven in the best sense. But, yeah, those different steps he's taken from, you know, being a journalist to being a novelist to being a screenwriter to being a director. Just to kind of... a true talent.
You know, I don't even have to have him on this show. No, we've done it.
Yeah.
You thought you were coming
like
on here
his,
to talk
I'm
about
like
you.
His, I'm like his Dick Cheney.
Well, you had a similar experience, though. I mean, you talk about, I'm sure, the Say Anything process for him to be able to direct it. That was an uphill battle. And you guys had that with Bottle Rocket to some extent, right? I mean, I rewatched Bottle Rocket last night. I hadn't seen it. I saw it in the theaters, and I hadn't seen it since. And I was amazed, first off, at how young you guys look in that film.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've watched it lately, but it's just like youth.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's this fresh...
I mean, really had not even, like, settled. It's like puppies.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly like puppies. I think when you come out of the water in the pool at the hotel, it's like you look 16.
Yeah, I mean, well, I'll think, you know, I've had all these life experiences. I really hadn't had that many. I mean, I was, was only, you know, a few years out of high school when we'd started doing that.
But. So when you guys made that film, it started out as a short, right?
Yeah.
And then it went to Sundance, and James Brooks said, I'll help you guys produce this.
Yeah,
and stuff.
Owen and Wes had written a full-length script, and I think maybe the Brothers McMullen had come out around then, and
right.
So they'd heard, you know, you could make a movie for a couple hundred grand or really cheap, and then found...
You just got to find a set of brothers that do everything.
Right, well, and a couple hundred grand, which we couldn't find. But yeah, I made the short. My brother Andrew really helped us get the short made, and you know, found the sound guy and the cinematographer, and you know, short ends of film, 16 millimeter film to make it on. And then my dad knew this guy L.M. Kit Carson, who was kind of he was a filmmaker that had. He'd co-written Paris, Texas.
Okay.
And he was from Dallas and kind of around Dallas, and my dad knew him and put us in touch with him, and he helped us get the short into Sundance.
Okay.
And then Owen and Wes went and did this Sundance summer screenwriting lab, I think, there, and worked on the script. And then when it was at Sundance, this woman, Barbara Boyle, a producer, found it, and she took it to Polly Platt. Who Polly Platt's incredible, kind of behind the scenes Hollywood producer, where she was married to Peter Bogdanovich, and she was the one who took Last Picture Show, the novel, to him, and she helped him make Paper Moon, kind of what are considered to be his best movies, and then
yeah.
She went on to work with James L. Brooks and was kind of his right hand person, and she's the one who took the Bottle Rocket short to him and said, you know, check this out. And then these guys also have a script.
Once the studio got involved and everything, wasn't it the same thing as like
oh,
hey,
yeah.
You guys, you made this great short, but now we're going to put real actors
yeah.
in there? Like, did they not want you and your brother in the film?
No, they didn't want to make the movie to begin with. And James L. Brooks had a production deal at Columbia, and he'd kind of forced his hand with Columbia and made them agree to make Bottle Rocket as part of his production deal, and then they finally said that they'd make it, and then they said, we'll make it, can we just make it without these guys in it? And I was like, let's take the deal as we get them on the next one. Let Wes direct this one, we get them on the next one.
Really?
But then James L. Brooks said, you know, there's no point making the thing if you don't have these guys in it. And so again, he kept, you know, pushing it along.
What does that do for your confidence? Like when you go on the set knowing that the studio folks are like, we don't want these guys,
I mean,
and we're being held over a barrel.
The funny thing is, it's not like we were brash, but we just didn't care, really. It didn't, I mean, I think maybe it might have kind of hurt our feelings, but it really didn't, like, I think it would bother me more now than it did back then. I mean, I do remember while we were making it, you know, it filtering back to, like, yeah, Columbia's not happy with the dailies. They think you guys are really weird.
Which, that must be hard.
Which is quite, because, like, now that I'm, you know, now that we've been doing this for a while, all you ever hear is dailies are great. Everybody loves the dailies. That's all you ever hear on any movie, you know, or any kind of project is how much they love the dailies. It's just kind of something people say. But on our first movie, they were very open about being like, they don't like it, guys. They think you guys look weird, sound weird. But again, like Cameron West is one of those people that is just, you know, driven, and kind of keep, I mean, so much of it is to keep things moving forward, where if you are too sensitive or do get caught up in the politics or this producer or that person, you can just get derailed.
Yeah.
And those guys just kind of manage to kind of keep it moving.
I don't understand how you can be that young and have the ability to filter that noise out.
I don't either. And I mean, actually, I asked Cameron about that, and he said he's just gotten a lot better at it. He said maybe it used to kind of maybe get to him a little more, because I'd said the same thing. I said, you're so good about kind of just moving forward and working on the scene and not worrying about, you know, or do we have enough time to do this, or the producer's kind of on our backs about getting something shot. But yeah, to think about somebody like Wes to keep things moving, knowing you've got a huge corporation that's been around for, you know, 100 years, not liking what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, you assume they know what they're talking about, and yet you watch Bottle Rocket and you see signs of what Wes was going to become.
Yeah.
Like, you see the lists and the organization, the plan that your brother's making as Dignan for how the robbery's going to go down. It's like Fantastic Mr. Fox, right? It's the bones of that excitement and watching the ingenuity of someone making a plan and getting, you know, getting...
And even, you know, pictures on the wall and certain scenes, you know, he's got, I think, like a Jacques Cousteau picture,
yeah,
or like a Lateague picture in the scene. But yeah, you can see kind of...
But how does that guy who's that young and then is hearing they don't like the dailies, they think you guys are weird, how does he go, nope, this is...
Well, you know, okay, that makes me think one thing that I'll think about, like, what kind of kept us going, and it was a great crew, like Bob Yeoman, the cinematographer, he seemed to think it was, like, funny. John Boccaccio, the guy, the focus puller. You know, so these people that were right there while we were doing it, they kind of seemed to be getting a kick out of it. And so that just shows how important having a good crew is, or people that are behind the project. And not that we were insulated from it, but it was, you know, we were showing up to work every day and we were back in Texas. You know, I mean, eventually some executives came down to kind of stand around, but by then we were almost finished. But, you know, there was, for me, there was a real sense of melancholy on it, to where as we got towards the end, I thought, well, you know, this will be the only movie I ever get to make, and I really love movies, and, you know, at least got to make one with my brothers and Wes. And
That was your mindset.
Yeah, that was my mindset. And I feel like that feeling almost comes through in the movie. Like, there's kind of a sadness.
There is a melancholiness. You attribute it to the relationship with the hotel maid.
Right. Or you know, the relationship with Dignan. But, yeah, I think, you know, as great of a little team we had, just thought, well, this is just something we took a shot at that maybe didn't work.
God, it's so funny to... You know, to make something completely original, and there's no way when you're in the middle of it to understand the impact
it'll
have. To me, it's such a great example of, you know, you being just excited to make a film.
Well, you know, it makes me think about, like, Mike Judge and, like, his sense of humor. Because that kind of thing, and even, you know, like somebody like Wes, you know, you can get that kind of sense of wonder kind of beat out of you.
Yeah.
Or, like... Hey, you got to grow up. Or, like, you know, I just know with Mike Judge, he was like the kind of guy getting told, you know, as a kid, like, you know, if you think that's funny, you know, you're sick, kid. Or, like.
Well, I think of Idiocracy. I think of the fact that that sat on the shelf for a year or whatever. That film was so ahead of its time and so funny. And the fact that it could sit on a shelf and have distribution issues. I think it's similar, I guess, to the Bottle Rocket thing where.
I know, I never get it. Like, at all the junk that they get released, how do they pick these kind of offbeat things that they might think are terrible, but, like, what's the difference between this and something that really is terrible? Just at least give it a chance? And that's kind of the dark side of Hollywood that you kind of come up against, is, like, the real aversion to something that's different or something that could, you know, potentially really connect with people. And, yeah, I'll think about, you know, Idiocracy is probably the thing that gets mentioned most to me these,
is that true?
These days. And, you know, I was reading the paper one day and saw that it was getting released, you know, and it got released on 7 screens and just completely thrown away by the studio. But yeah, that's just those things just always kind of seem to happen.
I guess you gotta
it's a tough
as an actor, you gotta divorce yourself from
it,
right?
And I really do. I mean, in a probably too much so, but yeah, I mean, it doesn't. And I think that comes from kind of Bottle Rocket not having done well from the beginning, and then having, you know, to have the studio not into it, and then and there were people at the studio that were supportive of it.
Uh-huh.
Like a guy named Michael Costigan really was helpful and supportive and nice to us. So, I mean, there were people. It wasn't like everyone was against us. But, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, like what I'm saying, when Sean Penn, like, tracked down Owen West, you thought, okay, the guy that, you know, we've been a fan of, you know, since we were kids, he really liked it. So that's really kind of all you need to hear.
Well, it's a real lesson on you got to stick to what is true to you.
Yeah.
And then let the, you know, maybe it's going to take a while for the world to figure it out.
Right.
You know,
still shocked when people say they, you know, when people, like you were saying, you saw it on in the theater, but, you know, it was only out a couple of weeks and then it was gone. But there were so many ups and downs. Like, it had these kind of famously bad test screenings where people were just streamed out of the theater, you know, showed it down at the Promenade in Santa Monica, you know, to people that were not kind of in the mood for it.
So when you're getting terrible test screenings and people are walking out, do you guys...
And it didn't get into Sundance.
The short got in, but
the short got in, but the full length. It was kind of like 16 minutes of this. Nah, well, that's good, but 90 minutes of these guys.
Yeah, just cut out, you know, 74 minutes and you'll be
yeah.
good. Well, I mean, did you guys huddle up at that point and say, you know, like, I mean, was there, I don't know, did it forge
we didn't huddle
bond?
Up, but we were all in rooms of the same house, kind of huddled on our own.
I mean, did you think that's it after the test screenings and all that?
Just didn't really know what was going to happen with it. At the same time, you know, I was, you know, going out on auditions and couldn't get a job, and just so it was all kind of, things were just kind of, it was not a good time. And then and that was a year and a half before it came out, so to get that first review.
Oh, did it sit for a while?
Yeah, it sat for a year and a half where they kind of tinkered with it. And
did Wes have final cut on that?
I feel like he did. I mean, and James L. Brooks had a lot of input and really worked with those guys, and they were, you know, really helped with the script. But I think they were really respectful of Wes. And
kind of amazing. I mean, when you think about the film, it has something that I think I've noticed in every one of his films, which is there's a character that's too eccentric to be accepted by society, but yet too warm-hearted, and his friends can't turn their back on him, even though they know he's a little off.
Right.
But it seems like from the start, Wes and your brother, and I want to ask you, like, how you guys workshopped this thing into... Like, was the goal to create characters that you hadn't seen a bunch of times?
Well, I think the character Dignan that Owen played, that was really the kind of character that was so different and strange and off. And
yeah.
You know, you couldn't tell if he was from, like, the 1930s or, you know, the late 90s when we made it, and just how he dressed and how he carried himself. And I just think Owen and Wes are real kind of funny, offbeat sense of humor. So what appeals to them and what appealed to them back then would have been things that were just kind of a little skewed and a little different, and what made them laugh. So what appealed to them were these kind of different characters, whether, you know, it would have been like Harold and Maude or like R.P.
Yeah.
McMurphy and Cuckoo's Nest. He's kind of like, what catches your interest? And I don't really even think they would have set out to do it. It's just what would have happened when
right.
those two guys sat down to work on the story. And I think it came from, you know, a story about a group of friends trying to pull off a heist. Like, we originally did want to do like a real heist movie. And then just as we kind of kept working it, it just kind of kept moving away from that to like a more comedic heist that these guys screw up. And I think that's just kind of what naturally came to them at the time for what their tastes were.
You know what I hear you saying is that when you have an original eye or an original voice as a writer, as a filmmaker, you let the stuff fall away that isn't you. Like, it just naturally happens, right?
Yeah.
Well, you bring up so many questions about the life you had growing up, the fact that Andrew and Owen and you and Wes bonded since childhood. And I kind of want to understand a little bit more about that. And as I was reading about you, I mean, I knew your mom was a photographer and is a photographer, but what I didn't know until I got into this was that she assisted Richard Avedon during some of the In the American West stuff, which is one of the books that made me want to be a photographer.
That's cool.
What an amazing project to be involved in, you know? And it made me wonder if you got to go to work with her.
Yeah, I did. And I mean, was one of the kind of major influences of my life, because I would have been
young, right?
9, 10, 11 through then, and got to go, you know, to all these incredible rodeos and state fairs from Texas to Wyoming,
She'd take you along.
She would take me along in the summers.
And he was cool with that?
And he was great, and he was an incredible guy. And, you know, she always had a great collection of photography books, so I knew about, you know, his pictures, and he was just, you know, one of those people that even as a little kid you could tell, wow, this guy's really special. This guy's exciting to be around. It's always fun to get to see Mr. Avedon or get to see him work or to go to his studio and like on the upper east side of Manhattan.
Yeah.
And just how exciting it was like to go in a studio with walls like this and to see how his assistants worked and his camera. But then to see somebody like Mr. Avedon, who was, you know, coming from like Vogue and that, or at least how he got
started. The fashion world.
And then, you know, these great kind of jarring, you know, photographs and portraits of politicians and things like that, to then him doing like working class American people in the West. And yeah, it had a real impact on me. And I mean, a lot of the impact was just the places we went, you know, to go
to
these rodeos in Montana on the 4th of July, and, you know, just the people you saw and seeing how Mr. Avedon would interact with these people and, you know, different motels you'd stay in and the drives between the towns. I mean, that's just one of those things that kind of sticks out in my life. I'm so glad she did it, because it would have been just so easy to think, oh, I'm working with Richard Avedon, you know, have too much at stake and, you know, I can't be looking after these guys. But it was that era where you could kind of just, you know, it was a kind of helicopter parents. Like, you know, they'd go to work and I'd be cruising around these state fairs or rodeos. You know, I'm sure I got, you know, money for a hot dog and a Coke and, you know, was just told to be careful and stay out of trouble. But, yeah, I think it was kind of a different time back then.
Did she photograph you as well and your brothers? And
yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. And so did, and Mr. Avedon took some pretty interesting ones of his.
Really?
Kid. Yeah.
Wow, what an amazing thing to, and I wonder if that, you know, that idea of even as a young kid being the subject in front of a camera, I wonder if that had any bearing on.
I think it definitely did. I mean, just in terms of, you know, being comfortable, you know, being in front of a camera. It is interesting to act on film now and kind of not, you know, to be able to not have to pose seems kind of like kind of nice even now.
You do just get used to it, I guess.
Yeah. I don't know. I definitely think that's kind of somehow played in, at least to making me a little more relaxed or calm in front of the camera than I might have been otherwise.
Now, as the youngest brother, you know, it's funny. I have a younger brother, but he's much younger than me. And I saw him more of as a, you know, I was his babysitter more than his pal, but you guys are pretty close.
My brother Andrew said he thought I was just a neighborhood kid until like the mid-80s. He didn't actually know I was his brother.
But it's interesting that you know, I think in a lot of families, there's a tendency to keep the young brother down and to not involve him. Like, he's a burden. You want to be with your friends your age. But I get the sense.
You sound like you've said that before. Hey, he's a burden.
Yeah. Listen, let's leave
Sam,
him in the backyard.
Sam, could you take him to the supermarket? The guy's a burden, Mom.
Just
go to 7-Eleven on my own. The guy's a burden.
Well, I'll tell you what.
He's always a half a block behind on the bike. I get worried. I don't want him to get hurt. That's why, right, I don't take him along.
No, but you're the opposite of all that, right? You end up making films together and projects. Were you always just sort of this creative family that did stuff together?
Yeah, I mean, we were definitely close. And, you know, both my brothers were always, their friends were my friends. And, you know, always was allowed to go along with those guys. And, you know, in the summer when we'd just be outside all day, you know, those guys always kind of let me tag along. And we never fought that much. I mean, it wasn't like it was some idyllic thing, but it's not like we were fighting with each other and, you know, hated each other. Like, you know, you'll hear about some siblings just going at it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I never thought, my dad, he ran the public television station in Dallas for about 10 years and then had a little advertising company. And then my mom was working on her photography and working with Mr. Avedon. So, and they also, you know, they had pretty interesting friends around, and, you know, would come across kind of interesting people like Jim Lehrer and John Graves, the writer, just kind of these different kind of Texas figures, a guy named A.C. Green that was a Texas writer. So there were those people like that around, and I know my parents revered them. So you'd see how your parents felt about somebody like that, like this writer or that photographer, and it kind of affected how you regarded them too. But I didn't ever think of us as a creative family. Like, my dad was the guy that was, you know, up and out the door to work, you know, real early. And my mom was a really good mother. So it never felt kind of like, you know, Warhol's factory.
It didn't.
No.
When did Wes enter the picture? In high school?
Owen and Wes met down at the University of Texas in Austin. They met in an English class.
And did you have acting experience or acting aspirations previous to Bottle Rocket? Or did they just say, let's get our little brother and put him in? And
it was more just kind of that I was around for the short and could play that character, Anthony. But, yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is movies were kind of the big thing in my life and their lives. Like, you know, how do we go see the Warriors, or how do we sneak in to see, you know, Officer and Gentleman? Like, what door do we prop in open? Which guy, you know, that was kind of the focus on, you know, a Friday or Saturday was movies. But I don't, you know, it was never, I hadn't gotten as far as wanting to be an actor. You know, I liked reading about actors. I liked reading, you know, good interviews with actors, but I don't know that I certainly hadn't decided to be an actor by the time I was acting.
That's so wild. I mean, was there a point when you realized, oh God, I love this? Like,
I don't know that I ever felt like I loved it. I was always kind of just trying to do a good job. And that's always been one thing I realize now, kind of working on it, is that's, I like moving from one project to the other, because I don't ever feel like, God, I really did a perfect job on that. So it's always like, okay, I took a shot at that, I'm done, you know, move on to the next one. But there are those actors who you see that are, you know, have studied and seem to have a better grasp on whether they have really delivered what they set out to do. And that's, again, like when you go back to somebody, that's why it is so satisfying to work with somebody like Cameron, because I can rely on somebody like that in a way that I can't on myself, because I'll think, gosh, this guy has great taste. you know, he's not thinking about the things I'm thinking about. He's thinking about not just my character, but the overall picture, and he wrote it.
That's so funny to hear that perception. Like, because I'm sure he's in his head sitting there going, God, Luke is bringing so much to this that I couldn't do with the writing, and he knows what he's doing with it, and he's informing me, and by watching him, I'll know how to write my next.
Well, that's just making me think about, like, I'd done this Western with Adam Sandler a year ago, and, you know, someone was saying, gosh, Luke, you did a really good job on that scene. I was just like, okay, thanks. And Sandler was like, can't take a compliment? And I was like, excuse me? He was like, can't take a compliment? And I was like, he was just like, that's okay, neither can I. But, you know, just kind of like, if you're not getting a note or try it this way, like, you almost kind of, at least I kind of would ignore, like, gosh, you did a great job there. You really nailed that.
So when you finish a take, what are you looking for from a director? Obviously, you're not trusting the you did a good job line.
Yeah. Oh. I don't know. That's kind of an interesting question. It's like, usually I'll just be trying to look into his eyes. Like, do I trust this guy?
Does this guy
know what he's doing? Are we in meal penalty? What the fuck is this guy talking about? Yeah, I just want to know that we got what we set out to do, or at the very least got what was on the page.
Okay, you know, so that brings up another question, which is, before you start a scene, what is the information you want to get most?
Just let me get a couple takes before you give me any notes, okay? No.
Give me about 16 takes, then you can look
at me. Yeah, just let me get a couple under my belt before you charge in here. And I mean, that's another thing that's fun for me, is just working with different people that have, like, different takes, and some people that really talk about it, and other people want to know your opinion, and then other people want to tell you, you know, what they're trying to get. That's one fun thing, is it never being set for me, and I know there are so many different angles to come in at it from. But going in, yeah, you've got the script, you've got an idea of what you're going after, so that seems pretty clear. But that's one thing that's kind of interesting about, you know, doing comedies or dramas. Like, doing a comedy, you know, just kind of like, you do a take, and like, do you think it's funny if you're in the scene with me, or do I think it's funny, or do you see, like, you know, the cinematographer laughing, or, you know, the director thinks it's funny, and that's really clear. So sometimes that's where, you know, doing a drama, or when you're trying to do something that's a little more serious tone, it can be just that the goals sometimes can seem a little less clear, because, like, how do you know you got it?
Right.
You know, the tears have to be streaming down your face for you to know that it was a moving scene, because sometimes that's, you know, that's not good either.
Do you think your acting's always been sort of instinctual, rather than coming at it from a process or a method that you learned? Is it sort of more your own method of getting confident about it?
Yeah, I would say so. But again, like I was saying, I mean, I really, that's one reason I like, whether it's another actor or another director, I like their take. And I mean, I think it's one thing I've learned as I've gotten older and done more, like, whether someone doesn't like to rehearse, that's fine with me. Or if someone likes to rehearse a lot, you know, I thought, oh, I don't want to rehearse a lot. You know, you're going to waste something that you might have gotten on film. You'll have done it in some, you know, conference room, you know, 2 months prior to the filming. But then after having done it, you learn that you kind of uncover things that you wouldn't have otherwise. So I've learned that, I mean, I just don't have a set way to do it. And then if someone's, their approach maybe doesn't kind of work for me, or if it's not helpful to me to do the best job possible, then it's just kind of up to me to do it, which is fine too.
It's funny, because what you're saying is that you're kind of reactive to the situation, but in the case of Roadies, you're the lead, and I would think there'd be some deference to, well, if Luke wants to rehearse, we'll rehearse, and if we, you know, so do you find yourself at times having to sort of kind of take the proactive role?
No, that's making me think about Carla Gugino, because she's so good about, you know, should we go over tomorrow's scenes right now? And I'll be thinking, what? Instead of, what about reading the paper, like BSing with the guys right now? You want to waste this free time working on tomorrow's? But she
typical younger brother.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but it'll work out fine.
Yeah, like come on, let's
not get crazy.
Yeah, but no, that's she's the perfect example of somebody that has like a different approach than me, and I'm like, thank God. I mean, I'll kid with her and I'll be like, now, Carla, aren't you glad that I had us go over this yesterday so that we were able to accomplish what we did today? But yeah, she's really good about being prepared and also talking things through. I mean, it's really an element of just like doing your homework.
Yeah.
Where winging it doesn't always help. And, you know, it can be okay maybe for a comedy where you do kind of uncover something and it makes you laugh. But when you're trying to do something else, I think, yeah, it demands a little more attention. And, you know, I remember working with Jeff Bridges on this Bob Dylan film, learning that he, and I know you interviewed him too.
Yeah.
And, but just learning that he gets the text down, he learns it kind of like a play a month or two out and then comes back to it when he's shooting. And that's a pretty interesting way to do it too. Just when I've had a couple of big speeches or more complicated scenes and taken the time to really work on them, and then it is kind of frees you up to not be thinking about the dialogue.
Do you have the brain that can put it in there and it stays?
Pretty well, and that's one thing you'll notice about good writing is it's you can learn it in 20 minutes or 10 minutes or half an hour, you know, 5 pages if it's well written, because it always kind of makes sense and flows. And then something that's not well written and is kind of disjointed, I mean, even a disjointed conversation has to be well written on the page.
Right, I think. It has to make sense to the character, what they
would
say.
And like, sometimes I can feel like I'll think, you know, gosh, this person didn't say this out loud because it just doesn't, you know, kind of have a flow. And Cameron, we were working on a speech for Roadies, and he was kind of, on the day we were doing it, making it longer, but kind of watching him kind of do it out loud, kind of quietly to himself. I mean, to where only it was in a whisper, but you saw him saying it out loud. And he came up with this speech where they were like musical notes. It was this speech about Elvis. And it was just so kind of, you know, you really saw a really great writer at work.
And having to and get watch, it on its feet.
Yeah, right. And watching him do it. And yeah, literally, he was kind of on his feet, you know, with the pen alone, you know, with all this kind of chaos of a crew and lighting and, you know, noise going on around him where, yeah, he was kind of standing alone, kind of building this thing up from the ground up in a great way, to where he came up with it and I was able to learn it, you know, on the spot, a kind of semi wordy, kind of complicated speech, but it was just so tight the way he'd come up with it.
Wow. You know, as you're telling me this, I'm reminded of, I listened to an interview you did with Terry Gross, and you told a story about being in an elevator scene, the scene with Gene Hackman and Royal Tenenbaums, and you tell a story about how you flubbed a line a couple times in a row, and Gene Hackman turned around and gave you a look.
Yeah.
And on the show you said, and it chilled me to my bones.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that was a watershed moment for you of, oh, this is, I'd never want that feeling again.
Right. Well, yeah. Gene's not somebody you want to wing it with. you know, but he's probably the person, I mean, it's no, you know, it's interesting that when I think about the people I've learned the most from, it's been the people that are the best. And like, he was just so good, and he never left the set and was always kind of sitting there quietly and kind of observing things or going through his script. But yeah, Gene's somebody that I definitely learned a lot from.
Yeah, I wonder why that moment stuck out to you enough to tell that story. I wonder if it was...
Well, it's the only time it ever happened, you know, and I... Because, I mean, I always, you know, always prepared, but, you know, for some reason, I think I had a, you know, I had a hawk on my hand.
Right.
So there was a lot going on, and we were on the elevator, so I had some physical stuff, so I did, you know, might have made a couple of mistakes, but, you know, Gene was, you know, could kind of look into your soul.
Well, okay, so as I'm hearing all this, I'm thinking about the kid that thinks he's not going to ever get a chance to make another movie and feeling melancholy about it, like this is your one shot. And then you're sitting here talking like, you know, you learn from the best and other people make you better. But you're in your mid-40s and you've done over 50 films and you've worked so much. And I wonder if that first situation on Bottle Rocket made you be like, well, I'm never going to take this profession for granted.
Like, I thought you were going to say too seriously.
No. But you know what I mean? Like,
I'm never going to fully commit to this thing.
See, you know, it's funny. You see, because I would think, well, here's a guy that's going to take all this work and make sure that you know, you get to keep doing it. I don't know, you hear about some actors and they want to have Brando's career, they want to have Pacino's career, they want to design this career as though it's like, you know, they're an architect designing the perfect building.
That would go back to one thing I've always felt strongly about, and that's that I've always loved character actors, from Harry Dean Stanton to Warren Oates to, you know, other people you see in the backgrounds of all these different movies. You know, knowing how that somebody like Jack Nicholson could very well have just been a character actor were it not for Easy Rider. And he'd been, you know, kind of bumming around Hollywood for over a decade by the time that happened.
Right, right.
And that, to me, is also when I'm able to kind of relax and sit back and learn the most, is with a smaller part. I mean, that's as close as you'll ever get to film school, is being in it and a part of it, but, you know, in a smaller role.
Do you remember the first time you watched yourself on a big screen with an audience?
I think these test screenings went so badly for Bottle Rocket that, you know, it's like your eyes were kind of glazed over and your head was spinning around because people were walking out of the theater.
Yeah, I mean, no joke. Lock the doors,
no,
please.
No joke. People were streaming out of the theater. So I didn't really get to enjoy it that much, but yeah, I can remember a test screening of Old School that was it was out in the valley somewhere, and I'd gone there after work, and I'd been working at this kind of little studio out off the Ronald Reagan Freeway, and I finished early, and then drove over there and went to the screening, and just people were laughing from the first frame to the end. And then I was out in my car in the parking lot, and there were these kids that were running at each other, high-fiving each other about the movie, you know, and like doing Will Ferrell lines. And I thought, okay, this is a great feeling. You know, and to see somebody doing, you know, what we would have done after Animal House.
Right.
Or, you know, after Smokey and the Bandit, you know, trying to imitate how Burt Reynolds talked or trying to imitate Bluto, you know, stuff like that. I thought, okay, that's, you know, finally might have something like that.
Well, do you ever think about coming out to this town and entering this industry, what the last 20 years of your life would have been like if you were like most actors, which you didn't have other, you know, other family members or a support system? I mean, can you imagine your life without the support system of your family trying to navigate this business?
I can't. And again, that's something where I'm like, how do people like drive out here alone and like do it and then make it or not make it?
Even worse, or not make
it.
Yeah.
But just to come out on your own. I mean, I just... You know, think about kind of how, like I was saying, like growing up, my friends were their friends. So I was always kind of following this group of guys around, including coming out here. But yeah, it gives you a lot of respect for someone's kind of grit and determination. And, you know, a guy like Cameron.
Yeah.
you know, doing it all alone, you know, just a kid from San Diego who I think his mom was a teacher.
Yeah.
But yeah, it makes you really have a lot of respect for those kind of people. And yeah, I can't imagine having done it without those guys. And still my group of friends is still kind of the same small kind of group of people that I got started with.
I mean, it is. It's a unique thing to have your family all sort of out here and in the same profession, right? I mean, are your folks out here now, or are they still in Texas?
No, they still live in Dallas.
They do, but you're still close to them?
And yeah, very close, and yeah, they visit a lot.
That's so great. Do you think you're still, in your mind and in your family, are you like still the younger brother?
Yeah, I mean, I think those roles, I mean, I think it's like scientifically proven, like the way those roles kind of lay out the same over, you know, generations in history. But yeah, it's, you do kind of play the same part. But yeah, it's interesting being, you know, the youngest, and then, you know, there being a middle and an oldest, and how you are on your own and how you are when you get together. I just can remember that this guy, if we'd go to a party, this one guy would always try and split us up. He'd be like, you guys are not going to stand here and just talk to each other, okay? You go off in that direction, you go off in that direction. You know, he'd literally...
Trying to help.
Yeah, well, I don't know if he was trying to help. He just didn't want us off in a corner just talking to each other. But yeah, I feel very fortunate to have come out with those guys and to still be so close to them.
Yeah, it's fun to hear you talk about this stuff, because it's weird enough for one person in a family to achieve this kind of success or fame or whatever it is, and to have it, you know, to watch your brother and watch you, and you don't have this ego that I would assume a lot of people develop in this industry, and it's refreshing. It's really, and to see that you're still a student of film and love it so much, it's really cool.
Thanks for saying that.
Yeah, well, thank you for doing this.
Thanks for having me. It was really fun.
Hey, folks, that's our show for this week, and it also happens to be the final show of our season. But fear not, because we're coming back in the fall with tons of new episodes. And here at Off Camera, there's been a lot of behind-the-scenes changes. You may have noticed we are now on a new podcast network, Podcast One, which is a veritable cornucopia of great podcasts, so check them out. Also, very exciting news, we can now be found on Netflix. You'll find some past episodes on there, and you can find present episodes not only on this podcast, but on DirecTV's Audience Channel and AT&T's U-verse. So what I'm trying to tell you is, Off Camera is basically everywhere. And we even make a magazine. So if you haven't gone to offcamera.com, go there, check out the whole site. You can listen to podcasts, you can watch full episodes of our show, and you can order our magazine. We make a limited edition one for every guest we have on, and they make a great addition to your coffee table. Not only that, but it's a great way to support Off Camera. And the best way to support Off Camera, for those of you wondering, how do I get more involved with this show? Well, tell your friends, tell your enemies, tell the world, tell them to go to iTunes and give us a rating, tell them to check out our website, just tell them about Off Camera. We love what we're doing here, and we hope it's connecting with everybody, so enjoy your summer, and take the time to go through our archive. We've made 68 hours of Off Camera now, which, even as I'm saying that, I can't believe it's true. So dig in, have a great summer, and we'll see you in the fall. And as always, thanks for listening.